This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
An unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000,000,000 kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good to be here and back with you all. After traveling quite a few miles, and the two part of the world I haven't been to before. One that in many ways isn't so different from where we are now. I think the most striking thing was to be able to feel the energy and continuity of the Buddha way in a familiar fashion. And to see, I might say, native Buddhists in their natural setting. And to be reminded that our practice has enabled the Buddha Way to, you know, circle the globe and remain alive as a profound resource for suffering beings. And something you can count on, of course, no matter where you go on this earth, or maybe any other, is you will encounter suffering beings. Tibet, of course, is an occupied country. At least that's kind of how it looks. And so there's quite a bit of very much a feeling of kind of some sadness in the air. And particularly when we went to the Dalai Lama's house there in Lhasa. It's a rather imposing structure. And, but as you know, he doesn't live there anymore. And most of it is inaccessible. And what is accessible is kind of a tourist attraction. But even there, there's a like a river of people's practice flowing through, carrying monks and nuns from elsewhere in Tibet who have made a pilgrimage to this place. And from which any obvious reference to the current Dalai Lama has been erased. Notwithstanding, he's still there. And the people who come there on pilgrimage are bringing him with them. And then, of course, there's centuries of tradition. There are various rooms and chapels devoted to former Dalai Lamas, famous ones. Some not so famous. And the air is very much alive with a feeling that, as I said, is familiar somehow. So it took some effort to get there. I was, in many respects, carried along by my intrepid companions, Tom and John, who made this possible, made this trip possible. And the Potala Palace is pretty high up. So like some of the cathedrals in Europe, there are many, many steps to climb and not a lot of air to breathe. So it was kind of, it took some doing to get up there. Only to find that the atmosphere of practice was very rich. And that was what was most important to the people who were visiting. And those who were there just to have their picture taken. You know. Well, that was okay. It didn't matter so much. What was most important to the people visiting was Shakyamuni Buddha's warm hand, still warm after many, many, many centuries. Of course, our way, in certain particulars, looks a bit different, but it's pretty clearly the same family. So we say there's one source. We say things like follow the stream to the source is a meditation instruction. Or we say hearing the words, you should know the source. And in a place like Potala Palace or some of the monasteries we visited, temples we visited, pretty important not to get too hung up on the, you know, the furnishings, and forget to always to follow the stream to the source. And that, in fact, that more than some simple generational cultural continuity was what was kept alive year after year after year, in spite of some fairly deliberate efforts to kind of make it not be alive, make it not important to people, substitute something else. Doesn't really seem to have worked. People ask, of course, what's the point of pilgrimage? And you as I think we've heard, the point of pilgrimage really is not to go anywhere. To come to the pilgrimage place and to realize that you haven't actually gone anywhere. I mentioned to some people that now I have, I think I told people I have, now there's three places I've been to on the earth that, where the spiritual heart was really, really obviously present. And one was Potala Palace, where we just were. Quite a while, for many years there, I had two. And one was the first one was the Chapel of San Damiano in Assisi. That, according to tradition, Francis and his buddy restored. It had fallen down, so they built it back up. And when I was there in 70, I guess, there was hardly anybody there, and the atmosphere just vibrated with something. It was very, very silent. It's kind of archetypal, you know, sun coming through a stained glass window. The whole place intensely alive with something. And then the next time I felt that was in Japan. In, when was that, 99 maybe? At the tomb of Kobo Daishi, Kukai, the founder of the esoteric tradition in Japan. His tomb on Mount Koya. Same amazing feeling of energy. And now the third. Dalai Lama's house. So that's pretty good. Three is like one of those special numbers, so maybe that's all I'll get. In which case, that's fine. I'm very happy to have encountered three such places and been reminded that the point is not to go anywhere. I am very grateful to have been able to go on that pilgrimage and to have a place and community of practice to come back to or come forward to something. In Tibet, it's very difficult to join a practice community. Government permission is necessary and rarely given. So communities that used to number in these several thousands now are 300, 400, and that's as large as they will be allowed to get. So I think there are quite a few people who wish they had a circle of bodhisattvas they could join, live with, practice with, but it's kind of out of reach. And so, once again, I experience our Bay Area, or anyway, our place. There's a, you know, a blessed realm. Free of some of the terrible afflictions that we saw in our travels. For the moment anyway, free of people shooting at each other and so forth. Seems to be enough food to eat for now, water and so forth. And not only that, but if we want to practice together, we can. So nowadays, this comes pretty close to a heavenly realm compared to so many other places. So, regardless, I hope we'll continue our practice of following the stream to the source and watching the clouds as they pile up. And in sharing that with others in all kinds of unguessable ways. I don't have much more to add. Questions about, you know, anything.
Do you think anything happened to you, aside from your insight that you were not going anyplace?
Well, apart from some degree of subtle transformation, it's always happening. I got attacked by bed bugs.
Stay away.
I think we took care of them.
Dear.
Yeah, I knew he'd appreciate that. That was transformative in a way, a very peculiar fashion.
Where were you staying when that happened?
In one of the best hotels in Lhasa.
There you go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But fortunately, it was a very new family of bed bugs. So, right at the beginning. And as a result, fairly easy to compass. But I'd never encountered them before, so. And of course, some folks live with them, and worse. So that was kind of interesting. Here in this otherwise clean and well cared for establishment. Yeah.
You mentioned the native, or did you say native Buddhists?
Yes, I did say that.
Was there any hit or impression that you got that how that those people compared to us or the San Francisco?
Well, there was, I'd say there was a degree of wholeheartedness that was very apparent. And it went without saying for many, many, many of the people that we saw. For many of us in the West, there's a degree to which the Buddha way is subjected to a certain intellectual assessment, and that if we find we approve, then maybe we'll go with that. But I didn't get that feeling that there was much doubt about that, and that the people who were so to say in it were completely in it, to the point where they were doing stuff like, they prostrate their way all the way around the what's that called? The circuit. There's that circuit, like there's the main temple, and people will do prostrations all the way around it. And it didn't look like they were thinking, I don't know about this Buddhism thing. It's like this, that was just not happening to them. And of course, that sort of wholeheartedness is exactly what Dogen says is the wellspring of Zazen practice. So that was both familiar and refreshing.
Yeah, I actually had the privilege of representing four Tibetan defectors who sought asylum in the United States. They came in to a program but decided that they could not and would not go back to Tibet. So they sought political asylum in the United States, and I spent a lot of time with them. And I agree with the lack of intellectual filter and the eagerness and the wholeheartedness that you had mentioned. It's a group of people who had a desire to practice but were unable to and prevented from practicing. But the focus had always been on the culture of proper speech, proper action, and it carries through. And they the consequences was affecting is the danger to the other family members
left behind. Yes, yeah.
But there wasn't a choice. And what was interesting was the observation of the American culture,
mm-hmm.
of that, a culture that has never had war fought in the homeland.
Yeah.
But the generosity and the spirit of the people in
mm-hmm.
this country.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of curious about their thoughts on that. They're
mm-hmm.
like, well, how do you get such culture of people with so much generosity
mm-hmm.
who tolerated not only other people's right to practice the religion, but their lifestyle and their preferences, and they were touched by that.
Yeah.
But they did stay. They stayed in this country and eventually brought in, we helped bring in other family members who were facing persecution. So it was a privilege.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, if there's a, or anyway, among there's strengths to be found and relied upon in the West, there is a certain, and anyway, excluding members of certain political parties, there's a certain faith in pluralism as actually a strength and a resource rather than a problem. So different people and different faiths and different languages and different food and different culture is not a problem, but something that can be drawn on and provide added richness to people's lives. So that is something that we actually can offer and do offer. Of course, the other reaction is one of kind of fear, and you know, it's much better to be kind of isolated in our little castle on the hill and keep all those other people out. Right? That's another response that personally I don't find very helpful. But as long as we can make some of the benefits of a pluralist society available, we should continue to do so. And I'm glad you were able to help those folks. Yes?
Curious. It seems curious to me that there are only three places. I'm not sure I believe it really. Three places in your life where the Spirit fell on you.
Why didn't you have to say only?
Okay.
So there were three.
There were three.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not necessarily that there are only three, but there have been three where it was quite apparent.
Right.
You know? But of course, there are many, many other places where such phenomenal manifestations are simply going on. But something about certain settings like showcases that. It's like a setting for a jewel. It's like, see, there it is. And of course, you brought it with you. It's not there, and you had to go see it. And that was part of the magic. And I hope that all those monks and nuns, some of them very elderly, we were told mostly from eastern Tibet, who came to Lhasa to make a pilgrimage to the Potala Palace. I hope they also had that confirmed for them, in spite of being herded through 20 out of 1,000 rooms, basically. Yes.
To what extent was it possible to communicate with people there with Tibetans?
Well,
and to get a sense of where things are headed?
Up to a point, we had a guide who was a native Tibetan and quite happy to answer questions as long as we were in safe surroundings. Various people had said that there are you know, the walls have ears. I didn't actually see that, but I'm assuming that people who live there know what that's about and how to be careful of it. But when we were, you know, away from groups of people, we could ask Tenzin, our guide, anything. And it was fairly clear that somebody has a very tight grip on things there and is not about to let it go.
So there's a new Dalai Lama, the Dalai Lama 2 or whatever, that will be or is?
Well, no, the 14th has said he's the last recently, which is quite startling for some folks. So I don't know if the Chinese are going to produce one. They could come up and say, well, we got the 15th, and here he is right here. Mm-hmm. And but according to Tenzin, our guide, the Tibetan people, they won't accept that. And they've already, the Panchen Lama is another of the most important lamas in that system. And he is basically captive. And whatever he says is kind of comes through the Chinese mechanism of propaganda. And Tenzin also said Tibetans don't pay any attention to that. They just ignore that because that's not their Panchen Lama. It's something else. So that propaganda mechanism is just going to keep cranking away. According to our guide, the Tibetans know the difference. So what's going to happen if suddenly there's a 15th Dalai Lama? I couldn't tell you. No.
Will the tradition be further diminished until there's
that's a good question. There have been a number of Western incarnate lamas discovered, including Steven Seagal, you know. It's a little odd, but okay. So where exactly that's headed, I don't think we know. But one or two of the, like that Spanish boy who was a tulku, I think he decided he wasn't really interested in that. Thanks very much. So he had a number of years of tulku training, and then I think he decided, I can't remember, he'd rather make movies or something. So, you know, something will happen. But how the tradition will continue to develop and manifest is hard to say at this point.
Did you get any impression that in Tibet there might be a policy of ethnic cleansing going on?
Well, yes. But of the sort that the effort is to dilute the dominant ethnic strain by importing many, many, many folks from the east of the country and fostering intermarriage and so forth. So it's that kind of ethnic cleansing. There's some other things that happen. Tenzin explained to us that once you get up to the Potala Palace and you're wobbling up there, gasping for breath, you can look down and there's a, it's quite beautiful, but there's a now a big kind of empty square, you know, sort of square of the triumph of the proletariat, something, blah, 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 I don't know what it was. Anyway, big empty space. And then there's a wall, and then what looks like a bunch of Tibetan buildings. And Tenzin said that's all fake. And that until, I don't know how long, 30 years ago or something, the people's houses were right up to the foot of the hill. But then the Chinese destroyed all those neighborhoods and moved all those people out and replaced it with this heroic square and then these kind of fakey Disneyland Tibetan buildings. So there's that too. There's moving populations around. And then, as I say, diluting the ethnicity. So it's not quite the same as having people come in and murder everyone, mm-hmm. but it's just as effective in its way. Anyway, that's how it looked to me. Tom San was also there. I don't know if you have another point of view, but feel free to share if you do.
I'm still processing everything.
Yeah.
sadder now that I'm home and look at it. It's amazing when you're there.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate your description of this stream, because that's, on reflection, that's what I saw, these people practicing that were up and down and all around, mm-hmm. and weaving in and out of this other system that was trying to force itself in.
Yep.
But the practicing, you know, there's the grandparents with the prayer wheels, mm-hmm. and the old guys with their malas still, mm-hmm. going all through this,
yeah.
even through the checkpoints and the
yeah.
x-ray machines and the machine guns.
Yes.
People are doing their thing.
Yes. It's very weird that practically all of these places you go, these beautiful temples, you go through a metal detector. It's like, and the metal detector invariably goes off, right? Everyone who goes through, beep, beep, and they just don't do anything. It's like, it's a terror device, basically, terrorizing people. So it's very, very strange. And then they have the wands, you know. Sometimes they grope you to see if you're, I don't know what, carrying hand grenades. Well, Tibetans aren't going to do that. It's like, what is this about even? You know, it's bizarre, frankly. So, I don't know. Well, oh, yes.
Just one more quick.
Yes.
I have heard and read that due to a concerted Han effort to install Chinese as the first language through education, that there's a new generation growing up that's whose first language seems to be Chinese, and
mm-hmm.
that they are falling away from their religion and culture and so
mm-hmm.
on. Is
mm-hmm.
that to your experience when you were there?
I didn't see that specifically, but without knowing the language, I'm not sure I would have had access to that level of things.
Yeah.
All the kids that I saw seemed to be speaking Tibetan. On the other hand, every sign, pretty much everywhere we went, every sign, like on a shop or a street sign or certainly government buildings, big Chinese characters, little Tibetan letters, almost everywhere. So there is, obviously, there is an emphasis on bringing up Chinese and kind of pushing Tibetan to the side. But as I say, all the kids that I saw all were speaking Tibetan, and that was pretty obvious. So maybe, you know, that's something that's in store for like the next generation, you know. And eventually we'll start producing residents of the Tibet Autonomous Region, also known as China in certain circles, who are illiterate in Tibetan. That's quite possible. Probably that first, and then they won't even speak it anymore. Yes.
Do you know what they're doing with the texts? The site? Are they translating them into Chinese, or are they just hoping they go away?
Well, that's pretty much happened. That is, the Tibetan and Chinese canons are well established, so you could say they're safe. Right? That process is finished, and now what's happening is they're coming into Western languages. But we did see any number of places where the Tibetan canon was, you know, they stacked in these lovely brocade-wrapped books, whole walls of them, you know, that are being very carefully looked after. So those probably aren't going to go away anytime too soon, but will there be people who can read them? That's another question. So at some point they'll become probably talismanic. You know, it's like we offer incense to these books we can't read. Great. Okay, well, anyway, as I say, I'm very grateful to have you guys to come back to. So, what you're doing, what we're doing, is, I think, vital to this world system. So please continue. Thank you very much.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place, with the true merit of Buddha's wisdom. Beings harmless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them.